The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to this week's Guardian Books Podcast. We're continuing this week with our self-set agenda of exploring the political effects of literature.
So I'm standing on the street outside Gaze the Word, London's first and now only remaining lesbian and gay bookshop.
My name is Uli Lennart, and the shop was founded in 1979, so it's a real pioneering independent gay lesbian bookshop. It's the first one of its kind in the UK, now it's the last surviving. It's tough out there for independent booksellers. I mean, especially when you're very specialist. So I've kind of come on board to try and kind of do things like our web development and try and sort of bring the shop forward in terms of kind of like looking at its future development, etc.
Do you read a lot of gay fiction yourself? Is that something you're passionate about?
Yeah, absolutely, I am. I do laugh with customers that sometimes I secretly hanker after a bit of heterosexual literature. But I really enjoy the kind of gay and lesbian canon, and also beyond it. I believe that good writing is good writing, but the beauty of gay and lesbian literature is that there's a affinity with theme, concept, sensibility. There's a sense of understanding which can be implicit, explicit in the cases of certain types of literature that form a connection for gay and lesbian readers and also the transgender community as well.
Are there particular books that have been very important for you personally in your own life?
Absolutely. I think the first gay book I ever read was Giovanni's Room by Baldwin, and although it's a bit dark, it was a real revelation to read that book, and also Becoming a Man by Paul Minetti, which I got out of Hammersmith Public Library when I was about 15 and really connected with. I think literature can liberate us and can facilitate a connection and a sense of understanding that we're maybe not getting in our real lives, and that can be quite a revolutionary thing for us.
So reading a book is a very individual act. Is that particularly important for people who are thinking about their sexuality, particularly at a young age?
I mean, there's a saying, isn't there, that the writer is the person who closes the door behind them and then changes the world. I think we as a community, if one can generalise, do tend to have a kind of a propensity towards kind of creative expression, originality by virtue of our individual and distinct kind of experience, which is kind of the gift of our difference. I remember reading Howl by Allen Ginsberg when I was about 15 and just being so enlivened and enriched and electrified by these words, do you know what I mean, and connected with it, and you know, meaning is primary, and meaning that speaks to your sense of individuality and difference as a gay and lesbian reader is a real kind of like mind bomb in a beautiful way, I think.
So here in the heart of London, Soho, on the corner of Old Compton Street and Frith Street, the question is, can literature, or indeed gay literature, change you as a person? Or can it change the wider world? Do you read much gay fiction?
Not really. I remember when I came out, my parents bought me the Penguin's Book of Collected Gay Literature, which isn't bad, you know, like, you know, Ian Foster, whatever. When I was a teenager, that would be something that would be good because it means you can kind of find what you're looking for better. The problem is that there is a lot of like pulp and rubbish. It's like with anything. So,
are there particular books that have been particularly important for you as a person at particular times of your life?
Yeah, Armstead Maupin's Tales from the City, without doubt. I mean, and that is like as gay as you get, I suppose.
And do you think that books can change the wider world as well as maybe change an individual?
Without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah.
I think one of the reasons why LGBT civil rights and issues were progressed hugely in the last 10, 20 years is simply because queer people are more prominent in media. We have much more exposure, and obviously books are a big part of creating that kind of, putting that knowledge out there in the sort of our cultural information sphere, as it were. But historically speaking, I think that gay bookstores were very important community centres for gay people. For queer people in general, they sort of formed social nodes.
Richard Lee reporting there. So this week we're looking at gay literature and asking if it can change the perception of a community or your own sense of who you are. But also, does labelling fiction gay stop it from being read by the public at large and making a difference? It's a question that seems particularly pertinent in the week when the latest novel from Alan Hollinghurst hits the bookshops. Though The Stranger's Child isn't overtly a gay novel, sexuality is a more movable feast than in most of his other work, my guess is that many people who were reaching adulthood when The Swimming Pool Library or his Booker winner, The Line of Beauty, came out, would cite them as books that changed their lives. But that's enough of Hollinghurst for now. We'll be hearing from him at length when he comes to our book club here at The Guardian HQ in August. This week's interviewee has written a novel about some of the individuals least likely to be browsing in the queer fiction aisles of your local bookshop, members of the National Front. Max Schaefer's debut novel, Children of the Sun, which has become a bit of a word-of-mouth hit since its publication last year, is based on research about skinheads in the 80s who were homosexuals themselves. The novel shifts between two time periods. In the early 80s, we focus on Tony, a secretly gay skinhead. Then, in the early 2000s, our key character is James, a posh young writer who becomes obsessed with Nicky Crane, a Thatcherite thug and neo-Nazi. First, let's hear from Max reading from his novel about Tony having a sexual awakening in a skinhead club.
A woman is taking money at the door, in her 60s, in a wig. She says to Tony, "How old are you then?" 16, he tells her. "Like French buggery you are. No drinking, please, love, eh?" Inside, it is all skins. There must be more than 200 of them. Apart from a few hanging round the edges or buying drinks at the bar, everybody is dancing, facing the front in strict lines. And they're all white, or nearly so. Tony looks hard and thinks he's seen a packy, but a smack from Dennis ends his reverie. "Come on," he says. And then Dennis does an astonishing thing. He takes Tony's hand in his and pulls him onto the dance floor. He does it with such ease that it's not until he's dragged him all the way into the line that Tony even notices what happened. It's his body that responds first, the whole thing suddenly bracing itself of its own accord for whatever disaster will ensue, a big panicky swill of nausea splashing up from his stomach, sudden heat on the surface of his skin. He looks up at Dennis, tries to pull away, expecting to see belated realization, the same animal horror reflected. But Dennis just grins and begins to dance and won't let go. Tony feels his blood throb in the tight grip. He looks round anxiously, but finds no reaction. People haven't seen, or rather, they haven't cared. Seen, but not noticed. The record has ended, and the rows of men are fallen nearly still, waiting for the next track. It begins with speech. "Now I want all you skinheads to get up on your feet." And Tony recognizes it, an old one. And popular, too, because the skins around are cheering and leaning slightly forward on their booted toes in anticipation, as if they'll start sprinting. Buoyed on his ebbing flood of panic, Tony readies himself, too, looking around him again as he does. And down the same row to his right, he suddenly spots Ryan, the lad from Nigel's car, who catches his eye and nods with a little nervous smile. Along the line in front, among endless slight variations in the pattern of braces meeting the waists of jeans, he sees in one gap two hands touching, and elsewhere fingers against the small of a back, and he feels Dennis, who has never let go of his hand, give it a squeeze, and the beat begins.
Max talked to our Richard Lee earlier about how he discovered this hidden story.
It started with a conversation I had at dinner, actually, with a friend who I can't even remember how the subject came up now, but he told me about this character, Nicky Crane, who's pretty central in the novel. Crane was this extremely notorious, extremely violent skinhead thug of the 80s who was constantly in prison and in the press for leading quite large-scale racist attacks. And at the same time, apparently, was leading this second life on the gay scene, and he eventually came out on TV in the early 90s, just before he died of AIDS. I thought there was a short story there, because short stories were what I was writing at the time. So I went and began researching it, and I realised there was way more than a short story in the subject matter.
For a Guardian reader like me, there's a shock in reading words like packy, used as if they were just normal words, especially in third-person description. Did you find this shock value receded as you wrote the book, or was it still fresh for you?
I mean, it was something that was quite difficult to balance because it was necessary, I thought, to have it in there. I mean, obviously, it's the kind of third person that's moving in and out of the character's head, and you had to show what he was thinking. But at a certain point, it just, and apart from getting too offensive, it also just got tedious to have every time a black character was mentioned, you know, for them to be called nigger or something. So I began pulling back on that.
That was to avoid the shock value wearing off, as it were.
Yeah, I think so. But it wasn't just shock value. It was also that it just made it really hard to read. In terms of shock value more generally, I think I did become inured to the subject matter as I was writing it. But, well, more as I was researching it. The beginning of the research was really upsetting and really shocking. And in some ways, the most disturbing thing was how used to the material I got after a while.
Did you find it creeping into your ways of thinking, your ways of talking?
No. Not at all. Yeah, it's over-familiarity with anything. I imagine it's like becoming a surgeon if you start off pretty squeamish. I mean, it doesn't mean that you disapprove of the stuff anymore, but you're just less surprised to see it there.
There's a lot of documentary evidence in the book. There's newspaper reports and so on. I mean, This is all real, isn't it? You haven't been getting out the letter set.
No, that's all entirely real.
Now, there's also a lot of dates in the text. I mean, it says, it is Monday, the 31st of August, 1970. Is this another way of trying to anchor what seems a kind of extraordinary story in reality?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, it is one of those slightly over-obsessive books where nearly every date and detail is accurate to the best that I can make it. It was because the subject matter was so far away from my own experience that I was trying to get as much authenticity to convince myself about what I was writing, so that then when I got into the discursive descriptive stuff, it felt, as you say, like it was anchored in something.
There's also moments of surprising tenderness. Are these drawn from your researches? Did you talk to people who'd been there, or are these things from your own imagination?
I didn't talk to many people at all. I made quite a conscious decision early on that one of the boundaries I was going to set myself was not to make contact with real neo-Nazis as part of the research.
Is this for your own safety?
partly for my own, at least, sense of safety. And partly because it really wasn't necessary. There was so much written stuff. The amount of material just in the British Library was so extraordinary that I did feel I was getting enough of an understanding. I'm not really sure there are secrets inside people's heads either to much of an extent. The way that neo-Nazis think is set out very clearly in the text. I don't think I was necessarily going to learn anything particularly more, apart from maybe anecdotal stuff about tenderness, as you say, which wasn't in the text. No, just at a certain point you try to write a human character who happens to be a Nazi.
But you felt that you were getting enough of the humanity of the people by reading the things they'd written and by looking at the kind of exterior signs of this subculture.
I think at a certain point you also just start from the assumption that everybody's going to be human. I mean, yes, a lot of the written stuff is just horrendous racist screeds. It's not, long interior monologues about how they were feeling particularly lonely the other night. But there was enough sense of humanity and definitely, obviously, of the flawedness of the individuals involved. And there are a few videos were particularly key, actually. A friend of mine did track down this Nikki Crane porn stuff. That was really extraordinary to watch because the way they were performing the fixed images of themselves was ridiculous, and the way that they were doing that in a very unconvincing way and looking very anxious about it, I think gave quite an insight into the people behind it. That made those sections easier to write.
There's a brilliant scene where your contemporary narrator, who's also investigating this subculture, finds himself in the British Library getting a stack of these materials and starts tut-tutting, very obviously, so as to express his disapproval to the person on the other side of the counter. Is this something drawn from life? Did you find yourself...
It's hamming it up a bit, but there was definitely an anxiousness about reading that kind of material in public, yeah. It made me very embarrassed and uncomfortable, and my characters may be slightly more visibly demonstrative and slightly more tongue-in-cheek about it. I mean, slightly tongue-in-cheek the way it's written, but yeah, those were obvious concerns.
Did you ever worry about readers confusing your opinions with those of your characters? Have you ever found readers, this was published in February, I think, have you found readers who've come up to you and made that confusion?
People certainly will take very literally anything written in the first person. despite I thought playing quite obvious games with that in the way I'd written the book. But I think you'd kind of take that for granted. You can't expect everybody to be as obsessive in the reading of your book as you are in the writing of it. Nobody has... Actually, that's not true. I was going to say nobody has assumed I was a Nazi. One of the people that gave me... Who wasn't a friend of mine, but through the publishing process, one of the people that gave me feedback on the text sent me this very lovely email with lots of fantastic comments, which ended with praise about how I'd treated the subject matter. And then I got a follow-up saying, God, look, I realize I've just assumed that you're not a Nazi, and I'm sorry if I've offended you by by my last email. So, but that was the only person that did that.
There's a disconnect between the material set in the early 80s and your contemporary characters, which I don't think is... It's not all about the extraordinary nature of your early 80s subculture. It's also about the kind of transformation that has happened in gay life between then and now. How would you characterize those changes?
I mean, the very obvious difference is like people sort of organizing anonymous hookups on the internet versus, you know, having to find physical spaces to do that.
Does the internet play a big part? Is it a story of from public toilets to chat rooms?
I mean, I think there's a lot that's happened, and I don't think anybody, at least I don't think I've successfully analysed it, but an awful lot has happened in the last 20-something years. I mean, there's been legislative changes that have completely transformed the relationship to the state. As slightly happens in the book, in the 80s, men were getting, you know, entrapped by policemen pretending to cruise them. Now they go around gay clubs handing out cards telling you who to call if you've been the victim of a homophobic incident. Is extraordinary. But there's been a sea change in at least large chunks of society. And there's been the commercialization, enormous commercialization of the community, so that, you know, when Tony's walking through Soho in the 80s, I think there's a gay pub that's just opened. Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Precious kisses, words that burn me. Lovers never ask you why. In my heart the fire's burning. What Max touches on briefly at the end of that interview is just how much life has changed for the gay community, as he says, from a world where the police would cruise to catch acts of homosexuality to police helping fight homophobic crime. But how much have books made a difference and been part of that revolution? Joining me to talk about this are the novelist Stella Duffy, the novelist, theatre director and all-round performer and person of the theatre, Neil Bartlett, and Paul Burston, who's combined writing with a day job as Time Out's gay and lesbian editor. Now, I'm going to start by asking you each briefly whether you have a key novel that's been very important to you. Stella?
I have two in terms of lesbian writing or writers who are lesbians. One is Catherine V. Forrest's Daughters of a Coral Dawn, which was for me seminal. I think I read it about 18 or 19. It was about a lesbian utopia that goes wrong, as all utopias ought to. And the other one is Jeanette Winston's The Passion. Not Orange is Not the Only Fruit, which I personally find a little didactic, but The Passion showed me that you could be a woman who identified as lesbian and write about straight characters and write them utterly lush and about storytelling, a woman writing men, particularly in the 80s when to be a feminist you had to only write about women. So both of those, and I think possibly The Passion more than anything else.
Paul, how about you?
I think the first was Our Lady of the Flowers by Jeanette, which I read when I was very young, largely because of David Bowie, because I'd listened to Jean Genie and realised it was a pun on Jean Genet, and went and found him in the local library and was sort of excited and also terrified by what I read. And the other one would have been A Boy's Own Story by Edmund White, which was the first book that I read where I felt I could actually relate to the character. I actually felt like that could have been my story. And I think from people of my generation, I mean, I'm 45, I think that had a very big impact, that book, in terms of describing a kind of very domestic, ordinary kind of guy who happens to be gay, which was very reassuring at the time, as opposed to these very exotic creatures who live in this kind of underworld, which, of course, is fabulous, but when you're 15, it's a little bit nerve-wracking.
Mm-hmm. Neil?
I've discovered different books at different times, because I think we make the mistake of thinking that you make all your discoveries in life when you're young. This is not true. Everything changes. Key books for me were like Paul, encountering Our Lady of the Flowers when I was 14, which is quite something. The first book I ever went into a bookshop and bought because I'd heard it was gay was Nocturnes for the King of Naples by Ed White, which did also change my life. My other desert island books would be The Heart in Exile by Rodley Garland and Carol by Patricia Highsmith.
Oh, that's, can I have Carol too?
Probably didn't read Carol until I was in my late 20s. Mm-hmm. So you're quite right about it changing at different times.
I didn't read Carol until I was nearly 40, and I thought, oh, now life is going to get even better.
Yeah.
Now, at the start of this podcast, yes, I mentioned Alan Hollinghurst purely because it's the week of his launch. When I have mentioned that we were doing this podcast, a few people said, oh, you can't have Alan Hollinghurst. He's not a gay novelist. He's a literary novelist. I couldn't understand that distinction at all. What do you think about that? Paul?
Well, I'd say he was both, surely. I mean, I don't know how he would describe himself, but I would describe him as a gay novelist. I mean, he writes about gay characters, he writes gay themes, often in quite a sexually explicit way. And certainly his career thus far has been one of a gay writer, I would argue.
And Neil, there must be lots of people who read The Swimming Pool Library or Line of Beauty who would have discovered themselves through them if they happened to come to it at the right stage or age.
I don't know if either of those would be the novel that you would pick up if you were looking for yourself, if we're talking about that very specific experience of the young gay person. I mean, this question of, are you a gay writer? And I'm sure Stella and Paul the same. It's the one you get asked all the time, and you want to short circuit it by saying there are two answers, one of which is, oh yes, and the other of which is, certainly not. They're equally useless, because the person who's asking the question, the onus is on them to explain what they mean by that question.
I also think there's a way of looking at Hollinghurst, which is, I think he might be more queer than gay. And I think there's a queer sensibility throughout his writing, as there is in Ali Smith, for example, who I do, you know, if we're going to talk about those who get the prize nominations, then Ali should absolutely be spoken about. And I certainly don't think many people go, oh, she's a lesbian writer. But her work, I think, is intrinsically queer as well as excessively literary, absolutely beautiful, and doesn't quite get noticed enough in that canon of all the lesbian writers we talk about. And I think it's partly because she's not normally doing a very traditional narrative, which a lot of the people we've already talked about are.
Paul, can you make the distinction for me between gay and queer?
My definition would be that queer is far more about disruption and about unsettling categories. So, for example, when new queer cinema came along in the early 90s, it was very much about breaking down narratives, not providing straightforward stories, looking at heterosexual lives from a queer perspective, as opposed to telling gay stories involving gay or lesbian characters. I think queer has changed meaning as well, hasn't it? It changes meaning with each generation.
Oh, yeah, all the young people have just decided that queer's theirs and they don't even have to be gay to be queer. Yeah. And all they have to be is a bit subversive. I mean, that's fine. You know, they can. That's fine. The words
change. It does carry with it a suggestion of subversiveness, which for a certain generation, gay became a little bit bourgeois in their mind. So gay became very safe.
But I also think there's a sexiness to queer that I think, whether there is or not, that people attach a sexiness to it because it's more interesting than gay or lesbian, which is an even more boring word, you know, and that people are looking hungrily for a new word. I mean, Neil's work, theatre work in particular, for years, Saracen was one of the queerest things I think I ever saw. That, to me, was as important also as a theatre maker and as groundbreaking as, say, The Passion at around the same time, which is a kind of melding of forms and bringing together storytellings that I do see as a queer form, actually.
Now, there's another aspect to this which comes up in your work, which is camp. How does camp fit into all this?
I beg your pardon.
You're the camper.
How very dare you. My pearls must be showing. How does camp fit into this? Well, camp is a great and complex tradition, both of subject matter. In the end, it's an untranslatable, an indecipherable tone of voice, I think. The most ordinary utterance in the world can be camp if it is conflicted. I mean, would you like a cup of tea? Could, if I changed my voice, become an extremely camp sentence. Where does high camp end and where does queer begin? The trickiest bit of the discussion is where intention comes in. Something can be camp without meaning to be once it's been misappropriated and reinterpreted, but some things are intentionally camp. So John Waters wants to be camp, Proust never wanted to be camp, but is.
it's not necessarily queer or gay camp, is it?
I think you should ask the Archbishop of Canterbury that question.
But you are a biographer or a psychobiographer, can we call it, of Oscar Wilde, the campest person in the culture, possibly.
I never really think of him like that. After all, his greatest work is called The Importance of Being Earnest.
Camp sort of way.
Yes, but he is the most deadly serious of writers, and he died for what he wrote, so that's rather uncamp.
I think he's funny. I'm not sure he's Britishly funny.
No, he's Irishly funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Lady Bracknell is very Britishly funny,
only when
isn't
she's played by Maggie Smith. It's just that we've got into our heads that she has to be a cross between Margaret Rutherford and Maggie Smith, which is invariably camp.
Stella, when I emailed you asking you if you'd take part in this podcast, you said, "I'm not sure I have any particular juicy viewpoint on the gay novel per se. That is, any more than anyone else has written books put into that category by others, not me." So you're quite resistant to that categorisation.
I'm extremely out. I don't think I ever get talked about without my sexuality being brought into it. And I'm very happy with that. I've been out for much more than half my life. I want to be out. I want to make a difference politically as an out lesbian woman. But I don't think that's all there is to me. Gay men get called gay men. I get called a lesbian. Now, using lesbian as a noun rather than an adjective is an extremely reductive term. I'm a woman first, and I'm probably a feminist before I'm gay. We rarely use the terms a homosexual anymore, but we constantly have a lesbian. And it's dull for me. And I want to be able to write lots of different forms. I've written in several different genres. I want to be able to write across forms. And I don't want people to question my right as a woman, as a lesbian, to write men, straight characters. And that is what happens sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. I want to be in all the sections of the bookshop, if there are any bookshops left. I don't want to only be in the LGBT section.
Well, you're in the thriller section, notably, aren't you? Which tends to be dominated by men.
Yes. Well, no, really, I don't think it is. I think that's a bit of a myth. I've only written 5 crime books out of 13. So again, I still get called a crime novelist, when actually I haven't written a crime novel for 5 years. There are some, you know, very successful and out lesbians writing crime. You know, Val McDermid. Oh, I was about to name someone who's not out.
Come on.
Patricia Cornwell, who was forced out. Louise Welsh has written across the genre. Some of Sarah Waters' books do cross into that genre as well as the historical genre.
Paul, your novels are quite light and frothy, aren't they? Is that now you're going to be very offended if I
no,
say
I'm
that?
Not
they have
that
sparkly
all.
Jackets and things, don't they?
They do have sparkly jackets. I write what I would call gay commercial fiction, but I don't write exclusively gay characters. I've written 4 novels, and 3 of them, half of the narrative is about a heterosexual woman, because that reflects the life that I lead. And the book I'm working on at the moment, there isn't really a gay storyline. There's a minor gay character in it who acts as a kind of catalyst, but the 2 main leading characters are a heterosexual married couple. I'm happy to be classed as a gay writer, because I do believe that my sexuality informs how I write. An element of using camp to subvert things. So I take great fun in putting characters in situations where maybe the gay and straight characters' actions and behaviours are the reverse of what one would expect. So you find the straight character behaving in a more outrageous way, and the gay character behaving in a more straight acting way. I'm happy to be in the LGBT section, so long as I'm in the general fiction section too. Most of the feedback I get through online forums is from straight women.
Neil, when Paul was talking about straight and gay, it made me remember Ready to Catch Him Should He Fall, which has a couple who go through all the motions that a straight couple would go through, but they're not. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that book is now, feels to me, and I don't know what it's like to read for the first time now, but in terms of being an Englishman, it almost feels like ancient history. It was written at a time when the idea that a relationship could go from one night stand through a courtship into the formalization of a lifelong union had to be imagined as a crazy, queer, radical, avant-garde trip of a narrative. Now, of course, it simply means you pop down the town hall. So the world has changed, and you would think that that would mean that that sort of writing is now redundant. I find the opposite. I haven't stopped finding love, death, or politics any more mysterious and engrossing than they were to me when I wrote that book, which I started when I first met you when I was 8.
It was 1992 it was published.
Yeah, but yeah. I was already writing it when we knew each other in, you know, 1980. That world has changed a great deal, but the things that my books are about, how do you love, why is it some people have the power to control their lives and other people don't, how does one live in the presence of death, how does one live with one's family, none of those things go away. And I don't mean they're eternally constant, I mean they're in ever-changing. Every 10 years, we wake up and go, we haven't even discovered what being a person who loves someone of your own sex means, because we haven't yet discovered. We're at the very beginning of our history, at the beginning of our culture. I don't think anyone in life wakes up going, now I've got it all worked out, or only people I don't want to spend time with. And I don't think any writer worth their salt goes, now I see what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. The writers who one really loves, you can read their books endlessly and they never fail to surprise. And also you can't wait for the next one because you know you have no idea what's going to be in it.
Now, Skin Lane, which was shortlisted for the Costa, was set in the 1960s.
It was.
And you, Paul, have also written historically. You've written particularly about the New Romantics in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the interest in history. Is this something that... you obviously, Stella, you've written about Theodora. Could not be more historical than that. I'm interested in this historical theme that keeps coming up.
For me, it was about looking back at a period when I, as a young fledgling gay person, wasn't really able to embrace my own identity and what was happening in pop music at that time, the sort of early 80s, sort of pre-AIDS, was extremely liberating. Top of the Pops was a kind of drag show most weeks. And then sort of by the mid-80s, AIDS had hit and suddenly it became, you know, squeaky clean soap stars and all that kind of queerness went away. So I wanted to sort of pay tribute to that era, which was that sort of that brief moment that I experienced as a young gay man coming out onto the scene before AIDS came along and the sort of party felt like it was over. So for me, it was really about, it was a way of dealing with that that made it sort of in some ways more touchable, because all of that sort of collective grief that happened during that period is a very difficult thing to address. Mm. For me personally, I find it very difficult to talk about and very difficult to analyse. So to talk about it through the story of a sort of aspiring pop group set against that backdrop was my way of dealing with it as a writer.
Lesbian writers haven't got that particular journey.
There were many lesbians involved in changing law reform for gay men. Mm-hmm. There were many lesbians involved in work against AIDS, but it wasn't our cause. Feminism was our cause. We leapt straight to post-feminism without having feminism. The lost feminist years, the feminism that didn't exist, that never changed the world, is the heartbreak, I think, for most lesbian writers, most lesbian women. That's the problem. So for me, going back, you know, to 500, writing about Theodora in a time before the church had fully taken hold, and I do blame the church for a lot of the things that feminism tried to fix, before the church had fully formed itself, was actually a real liberation. As women, because we didn't have feminism, as lesbians, because we didn't have the law against us, and because Queen Victoria didn't believe we existed.
Is that true, or is that apocryphal?
I don't know whether it's true or not, but we have been made invisible. Mm-hmm. And we have colluded with that at times because we haven't wanted to be out. Men have particularly wanted to make us invisible, including gay men at times, and still now, including gay men at times. The moaning woman is always a stereotype, and she comes up time and time and time again. And it's much harder, I think, for women to address that in their writing, because actually all you're addressing is saying, I'm not moaning, look at me, I'm not moaning. Well, it's almost impossible, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know.
So Theodora, the way you have portrayed Theodora, is a strong pre-church woman.
She is a
That's
Christian
why you
woman,
chose
but it's pre the modern church. No, I chose it because she's just such a juicy story. She's fantastic. I mean, it's a palace full of eunuchs who are bound to be, you know, getting off with each other, I've decided. I've given her a lesbian lover at one point in her life. She marries Justinian the Emperor and takes over, you know, what was the dregs of Rome. She's fantastic. She's incredibly juicy. She's, you know, wonderful. That's why I wanted to write the character. But in that, as in all of my books, including The Room of Lost Things about two heterosexual men, there is always gay characters because I live in a world in which there are always gay characters. There are always black characters because I don't live in a world that's only full of nice white middle class Hampstead people.
Yeah.
I don't want to write the Hampstead novel and I've never tried to. I don't want to write a novel that says we're all white, we're all middle class and we're all 45.
Perhaps it just struck me, perhaps actually what you've all three got in common is you're sort of refuseniks to some extent.
It's only because they didn't want us.
I'd be very happy to share the Refusenik bus with Stella and Paul any day of the week. Yes, I suppose we have, to some degree, our writing is against things. And also at certain points in our professional careers, we've been discriminated against. So, yes, I mean, going back to Paul's comments on what distinguishes queer as a label from gay as a label, there is an element of troublemaking. But I have to say a lot of that is perception. I've never sat down at my desk and gone, right, who am I going to upset today? I sit down at my desk and try and write. I don't know what I'm going to write until I start writing it. So I think the question of intention, you know, do I want to achieve this when I write this novel? Did I sit down and go, right, Skin Lane, I must write something about the summer of 1967. No, I wanted to write something about something that people don't talk about, which is men's experience of shame, absolute internal corroding, blush-inducing, heartbreaking, and also heart-mending shame. That was my subject. It so turned out that several years into writing the book, it turned out this story was going to take place in 1967. But I'm afraid I'm entirely lacking in didactic intent when I write.
I think the thing about intention is really interesting because I feel exactly the same. I don't sit down to fix a problem in a novel. As I said with Theodora, it was a really juicy character. Therefore, I wanted to find out about the story. But I think a reader brings intention quite often. Just recently, a nice heterosexual man said to me, oh, I was surprised there weren't more lesbians in whatever book, The Room of Lost Things, I think it was, which there are no lesbians. And I was like, well, that's your view of what I should have been doing. That's where you came to my book. It's not where I came to my book. I came to my book to tell this story. There was no room for a lesbian character, so there wasn't one.
Do you read each other's books? You obviously get on very well.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, I love Bartlett's work. I do love Bartlett's work. Paul and I have done millions of gigs together now, actually, and so I've ended up having to read him, not least because he's read at least half of his books to me. And after you've heard all the juicy bits, you have to go home and you go, well, what else is there? You know, they can't all be full of juicy bits.
So do you think of yourself as a community of writers, or are you just three writers who happen to
I believe very strongly that one should nurture the idea of there being a community of writers,
and I
run this salon at the South Bank called Polari, and we're doing the Polari First Book Prize next month, which is an award for a first book by an LGBT writer on LGBT themes. And I believe very strongly that we need to do that because we're still not out of the woods in terms of having the same opportunities, the same amount of coverage, the same amount of lack of discrimination that other writers get. So I think it's important for us as LGBT writers to support and encourage one another. And I've always believed that very strongly.
And it's brilliant as well, because this certainly wasn't any of this. I mean, my first book came out in 1994 and it was published by Serpent's Tail, which is marvellous because that great indie press. But all the same, I was turning up to gigs and not knowing how to be and what to do. And with Polari, with Damien Barr's salon event, there is a lot more help.
Well, I can see that we're going to have to reconvene this discussion when Polari happens. But until then, thank you very much, all
thank
of you,
you,
for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Off the rails I was, and off the rails I was happy to stay. Get out of my way. On the rack I was, easy meat and Piccadilly Polari was just silly slang between me and the boys in the my gang. So bone out of order, oh you lovely.
So that's it for this week. Richard Lee joins me again to tell you all about the exciting things that are coming up over the next few days. But first, Richard, you masterminded a hugely successful stunt involving our 100 best non-fiction books, didn't you, this week?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know if I can claim very much credit for what was a collaborative venture at all stages. It's something we had a lot of fun with, assembling a list together across the whole desk, though we found very rapidly that 100 books wasn't really all that many. So we started trimming things down by a very strict one book per author rule and choosing books which we thought were ways into an author's work rather than necessarily the very pinnacle. So, for example, we chose Plato's Symposium rather than his Republic. And also, we're trying to balance things that were readable with things that were original and groundbreaking at their own time, and also things that were kind of important culturally. So even though the idea of coming up with a definitive list is a bit of a mug's game, really, there's some really great books on the list.
The thing that was your idea, which I think I can pin to you, was the idea of involving our readers and then running over several days their responses to our list.
Well, this is, of course, kind of the point of these lists. It's silly to think you're going to come up with a definitive list of the 100 best books, but what they certainly are is a way into the subject and a way for starting off a great conversation. We had a really interesting discussion about what best non-fiction could possibly mean for books about science or books about philosophy, technical books. Have some like Dapper Gent despaired at humanities graduate genotypes who could produce a list with only 6 titles on it about science or mathematics. They're branding the whole enterprise in, as he put it, the language of the internets.
So they came up with a list of how many science and books were there?
Oh, they came up with a list of over 100 books, which we should have put on our list of 100 books, including some fantastic, I mean, some great recommendations. Like, for example, Albert Einstein, who we'd ruled out specifically.
Shame on you as a physics graduate, Richard, for ruling out Einstein. How could you do that?
Well, it's just, I thought, frankly, that when he starts getting into the intricacies of the Lorentz contraction, there's just too many square roots lying around.
Oh, too many square roots. Okay, let's move on now to biography and memoir. That's another area that there was a big response around.
No, absolutely. We got, again, some fantastic recommendations. But the thing that I thought was interesting about it is that biography and memoir maintain their kind of immediacy, even though it's, you know, hundreds or thousands of years old, in a way that books about science don't. I mean, think about Newton's Principia Mathematica, for example. Obviously, groundbreaking work, something that changed the universe, changed our way we think about it. But nobody could possibly, well, only a historian or a philosopher of science would be interested in his method of fluxions, which was a really odd way of doing calculus, which is superseded by Leibniz.
Now you're going off into a physics lecture, Richard.
Oh, well, stop.
I'm going to have to now call you to philosophy, which was quite a contested area, wasn't it? Lots of people argued about what philosophy was.
Absolutely.
Whether it was worth including at all as a category, which I found fascinating.
Very much so. There are people who are saying that some of the books we'd included, like Descartes, were simply out of date and superseded by other more modern philosophical works. There are others saying that it was all too technical. I mean, we put on Hegel and we put on some Kant as well, thinking that these were books that, which, even though a little bit difficult, were kind of crucial to a lot of the way that people think about the world and change the world in their own time. But people were despaired of ever getting through Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. Or equally, again, they were despairing of us not having anything from the 20th century. Again, definitiveness is not possible.
No.
But what we've got, a list of other suggestions, which
find. How many readers actually put positive suggestions as opposed to just damning us for hours?
Well, I mean, we had lively suggestions in the comments field underneath, and as I say, we garnered via this spreadsheet more than 1,000 recommendations across the genres, we've been putting out through the week.
That's really impressive. Where do you go to find them?
Well, you'll find them all linked together on the book's website. So if you look for our top 100 non-fiction list, you'll find it from there.
Now tell us what else we've got coming up during the week.
Well, on Saturday, The Guardian Review has got Rachel Cusk writing about the new feminism.
Of course, that's very, very topical at the moment because of the Caitlin Moran book that's been everywhere, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, just through the Orange Prize season. So feminism is very much on everyone's lips at the moment. And on Sunday, The Observer New Review has also got an extract from Janine De Giovanni's memoir of the personal cost of being a war correspondent.
That's pretty topical too, isn't it, in a rather sadder and wiser way. But that's all from us this week. Thanks very much to Richard Lee, Max Schaefer, Stella Duffy, Paul Burston, Neil Bartlett and our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye. Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry?
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk /audio.